For 100 years, the Emperor had ruled without a single dissenting vote from among the billions of honored dead. The dead never argued, never even disagreed. For them to consider removal of the sovereign seemed unthinkable. "Hobbs," he started, waving at her to slow down. His mind fought to locate the questions that would straighten out this strange new world. "What the hell?" was all he could manage. She started to speak, and Marx winced. Kathry Hobbs shook her head, laughed. "Master Pilot, I think you should rest now." She took his shoulders, touched him. Things had changed indeed. "We've lost so many, Joachim. It's good to have you back," Hobbs whispered. Marx simply nodded and leaned back on the sickbed. Suddenly, he was exhausted again. The XO left him there, the lights dimming as she exited the private sickbay cabin. He leaned back, and his mind roiled now, full of questions, confusion, sheer energy. Marx felt as if he'd drunk a pot of coffee after a full day of meetings, his mind tired but buzzing. Deep breaths had only the slightest calming effect. He exercised his fingers, forcing himself to think about how good it would be to fly again. Then he caught the eyes of the Rixwoman. She was still here, watching him, observing, as if monitoring a patient, awaiting some expected symptom to evince itself. The dead woman stood beside her, their shoulders just touching with the casual intimacy of old lovers. Marx locked his gaze onto the Rixwoman's, focusing himself. Somehow, her implacable stare calmed his mind, her violet eyes glowing like meditation candles in the dark cabin. The rhythm of his breathing slowed, and he felt the cycle of the dream tide again. He heard the ambient sound of the ship, the ever-present hum of engines, air system, and gravity generation. Something was different. Without releasing the commando's gaze, Marx placed his hand on the side of his bed, palm flat against cool metal. The ship hum was stronger there. He let the dream phantoms, the reverberations of his fugue, align themselves to the frigate's vibration. Memory and metal conjoined, like the many instruments of an orchestra tuning to a common pitch. They matched the flicker of the Rixwoman's eyes. She smiled at Marx. Then the two of them together, yes, they were lovers, he suddenly knew, left him. And the master pilot understood the deal that the captain had made. He wondered what must be arrayed against them, their lone ship in the deep, to have motivated Zai to let this thing aboard, to have allied his vessel and crew with the Empire's sworn enemy. Perhaps Lawrence Zai didn't even know, didn't understand the extent of its subtle, pervasive occupation. But Marx knew. He had spent 100 days inside its belly. He could see its signs and hear its music. Like a vortex of wind revealed by the leaves, dirt, and debris it captured, the shape and scope of Alexander were clearly marked. The Lynx had been taken. The Rix were here. 10 years earlier, Imperial Absolute. Marine Private. Marine Private Second Class Basirits explained it again to his new crewmates. "Just Basirits. In the village where I come from, we only have one name."
"Only one name?" Astra shouted above the roaring crowd. "Better than none at all," Master Private Torval Salmon assured him.
"Better than one too many," Astra added.
"How many names would be too many?" Basirits asked.
"Not how many, but which ones?"
"Retired.
The late Corporal."
They laughed at their own jokes and clapped Basirits on the back as if he'd made one himself. He didn't completely understand, but didn't press his mates with questions. He was relieved at their good humor, knowing from his travels that in some cultures a single unadorned name was a badge of shame, or a mark of servant lineage. But these Lynx Marines all had wide experience. They'd seen far stranger things. The crew of the new experimental warship was drawn from the cream of the Empire. The Sirits knew that he himself only rated selection due to his high scores as a marksman and close combatant. He was younger and less educated than his squad mates. The fire team was perched, alongside 100 or so of their crewmates, on the gantry supporting a huge false Lynx. The facsimile of their new ship loomed up behind them, 2 kilometers tall. But it was not a figment or ghost sight. The dummy ship was real, physical at least. Basirits had begun to realize that no expense was too absurd here on home. Not for a pageant or party. Before them, filling the great square before the Emperor's Diamond Palace, was a huge crowd of cheering citizens. an uncountable host, far more people than Basiris had ever seen in his life. Not merely in one place, but more than all the people the young private had ever seen, put together. That fact bounded around inside his head, a realization as sovereign as the glittering facets of the palace as it caught the strangely white light of Holmes' large sun. This horde seemed to be the Empire entire, assembled to send off the Lynx's crew. Master Private Salmon grasped his arm and pointed into the crowd.
"She's got something for you, Bass!"
The single name, indeed, didn't bother his squad. They'd shortened it already. Basiris's keen eyes followed Salmon's gesture and spotted a woman among the ecstatic dancers in the front of the crowd. She had removed her jacket and tunic, ignoring the autumn chill, bearing flesh pale enough to shine like a ray of sun among the grey throngs of the faithful. Then others followed her example, men and women dancing out of their clothes, euphoric and supplicant before the towering mock totem of the warship. Basiris shook his head in bemusement. The grey religion took on many forms throughout the Empire, but here on home all its strangest versions were clustered together, as if the planet were a curio cabinet stocked for the amusement of the Risen One himself. The ecstatic dancers had seemed like monks to Basiris at first. He had watched them over the last few days and camped in the square before the rising dummy ship. Their grey tents and clothes, shaved heads, quiet prayers, and a diet of cold field rations had given them a solemn dignity. But now he saw that the purpose of these privations had been to secure a position in the front of the crowd. To dance and scream wildly, now nakedly, before the crew and the onlooking masses. To become part of the spectacle of christening a new class of imperial warship. To pay their respects.
"You'll catch flies, Private Second Class."
Basiris closed his mouth and smiled to echo the laughter of his squad mates.
"Bass has never been to a christening, I suppose."
"Neither have you, Astra."
"But I'd seen war prizes presented. The dancers were there."
"The dancers are everywhere."
"There were a couple in your room last night, I overheard."
"Those were honest surrogates, Private."
"I'm sure you kept them honest."
"I kept them awake."
The squad laughed again. Basiris felt warm in their company, even in the chill wind. It was new and wonderful to be here up above a crowd, arrayed with his crewmates on the slender beams of the gantry, almost flying over the press of people. He had never felt so exalted before. His eyes scanned the buildings that rose as straight as cliffs around the square. The wide balconies were full, glittering with the reflective clothes of the wealthy, as if the city itself were bejeweled for this event. Basiris had heard fantastic stories about the cost of rooms on the square, which could not be owned, only leased from the apparatus or temporarily bequeathed to high office holders, such as senators and visiting planetary governors. Wealthy families exhausted whole fortunes to rent them, if only for a few days, in hopes of establishing connections, rising a little higher in the social order, nearing the ultimate prize of elevation. They were all out to gaze upon the mock ship, glittering and awestruck, yearning for immortality. And with that thought, Basiris realized why his crewmates were so deliriously happy here, suspended above the horde, under the gaze of the Empire's plutocrats. They felt their true value as soldiers, saw a prefigurement of their true reward. For their grueling service, the years confined on tiny ships, the decades lost to the time thief, the constant danger of sudden obliteration, they were granted the one prize that even the wildest wealth could not absolutely guarantee. If they could just die in combat, cleanly and without too much brain damage, or enjoy long and exemplary careers, Basiris and his squad mates might live forever. Forever. A period not even the time thief could steal. He could see the Emperor's promise here, from this vantage above the crowd. As his incredibly sharp eyes scanned the balconies of the powerful, Basiris' elated thoughts were suddenly interrupted. Alone on a small veranda were two figures, one wearing civilian white, the other military black. An odd couple. The man in black seemed familiar. Basiris squinted, focusing on the pair. The man turned to profile, making some comment to his companion, and the young private started.
"It's the captain," he cried.
"Where?"
"Not a chance. Won't be here for hours."
Basiris pointed.
"There, on that balcony, with that woman in white."
The others followed his gaze, cupping their hands against the glare of the sun now spilling into the square.
That's the secularist senatorial block. You wouldn't catch the old man in those abodes. Master Private Salmon had served with Lawrence Zai before. Zai's Vaden, Bass, not some pink. But it's him. I can see him clearly. It's at least a click away, young man. You're hallucinating. The two figures on the balcony grew closer, first hands touching, then bodies drawing near against the cold, then white and black intertwined. He's kissing a woman up there, Basiritz announced. Ha ha! Salmon yowled, almost doubling over against the gantry's handrail. The captain kissing a pink senator! Kissing anyone at all, Astra added in amazement. The squad laughed at Basiritz's fine joke on them, slapping his back again, full of good humor and intoxicated by their imperious position above the crowd, above the naked and gyrating dancers, above the grasping wealthy. Above everything but the huge false ship behind them and its real and lethal double in high orbit above, where they would soon be lofting to join it, to journey toward the rumored troubles of the Rix frontier. They laughed that the possibility of death awaited them. But Basiritz frowned. He alone could see that it was, in fact, the captain. He could see that it was a long and vigorous embrace. And in his small village, the elders had taught Basiritz one certain rule. Never laugh at a kiss. A kiss was mysterious and powerful, fragile and invincible. Like any spark, a kiss might fizzle into nothing or consume an entire forest. A kiss was no laughing matter. Not for the wary. A kiss could change the world. End of The Killing of Worlds, Succession, Book 2 by Scott Westerfeld. S-C-O-T-T W-E-S-T-E-R-F-E-L-D. Read by Steve Douglas Craig in the studios of Potomac Talking Book Services Incorporated for the Library of Congress, April 2005. Published by Tor, Tom Doherty Associates, LLC, 175 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10010. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.